We do have an email here already from an anonymous listener. I don't tend to take anonymous emails, but this one is pretty good advice, it sounds like. When I get up in the morning, I have two choices. I can be happy or unhappy. I choose to be happy. When it's raining, cold, and miserable out, I just remember that 40,000 feet straight up, it's a beautiful sunny day. As my father always told us, life is what you make of it. This kind of gets back to the old Abraham Lincoln statement, Rick Hansen, doesn't it, about most folks are as happy as they make up their minds to be?
That's, I think, partially true. And what I mean by that is that, like the caller, you know, I think having a good perspective on things, seeing the whole truth, not just the part of the truth that the Stone Age brain tends to fasten on, you know, the bad news, that's really important, seeing the whole truth. But it's not, how can I put it, but it's important to not just have a positive experience. What's important is that we actually weave it into neural structure. Otherwise, it's wasted on the brain.
So it's more practice and more actual work involved here to get this integrated into.
Yeah, again, you know, half a dozen times a day, less than half a minute at a time. But if we don't actually take that time, as a longtime therapist, it's actually been quite humbling for me to appreciate that most positive experiences are wasted on the brain. They don't become any kind of lasting structure. And if they don't become lasting structure, there's no learning. There's no steepening of a person's learning curve. There's no takeaway in terms of becoming more confident, more moral, more mindful, more compassionate, happier, more functional, what have you. There's no learning. So when a person does take that 30, 40,000 foot view, as your emailer is saying, you know, it's also really important to take the extra 10 seconds to help that perspective sink in. So it becomes increasingly your own habit. In effect, I'm really talking about the how of developing good habits, using that term really broadly.
We have heard the term neuroplasticity used by several guests in the last few months and last couple of years, I guess, actually. So we're up on the concept of the ability of the brain to rewire and find new neural pathways and all that sort of thing. But you talk about experience-dependent neuroplasticity. How is that different, or what's the subspecialty there?
Sure. In general, in terms of neuroplasticity, that just means that, as you know, the capacity of the brain to change itself. Experience-dependent neuroplasticity refers to the changes that occur through conscious experience, you know, what we think or feel or want moment to moment. Self-directed neuroplasticity is the idea that we can take charge of this structure building our process ourselves from the inside out. The brain is the organ that learns. It's continually changing its structure, and it's biased toward changing its structure toward anxiety, depressed mood, irritation, or stress. So the question really is your brain changing for better or worse, and also who's doing the changing? Is it the forces outside us impacting the Stone Age brain? Or from the inside out, are we looking for those opportunities, again, in the flow of everyday life, most of them individually mild, all of them authentic opportunities, to take the extra 10 or 30 seconds to use the methods in my book based on hundreds of studies in the neuropsychology of learning? Are we taking those opportunities to draw the good into us so we increasingly have it inside, unconditionally present already, wherever we go?
You write about picking, when you think about these things, the experiences that serve you most, and I would think that would tend to work in both positive and negative experiences.
That's very interesting. You read the book closely. I appreciate that. Yeah, if you think about it, one of the most powerful ways to use the opportunity that's available to us in everyday life to rewire our own brains gradually and authentically is to zero in on those experiences that would be the basis of, the natural basis for, those particular strengths or qualities or perspectives or emotions that would be really good to grow inside yourself to deal with some difficult thing, either a challenge in your life these days, such as raising a young child or taking care of an aging parent. I've done both. Or maybe you're dealing with some kind of wound or a sense of emotional neglect from your childhood. You know, in my own case, there was a longing in me related to being extremely young going through school for more experiences of being valued and included in groups of people by my peers. So if you know what your issue is, as it were, then it's natural to ask yourself, what resource, if it were more present inside my mind, would really help here? And then you can look for opportunities to have experiences of that resource. For example, moments of feeling cared about by others, or moments of experiencing some sense of accomplishment, or moments of sensing your own inner strength or feeling protected, let's say, if you're grappling with issues of anxiety. You can look for those moments and gradually use them as what I call antidote experiences to address your underlying needs.
So this involves obviously some frankness, some honesty with yourself to understand what it is that you lack. As you describe it in the book, a hole in your heart that needed filling. You figured out how to fill yours. First of all, does everybody have a hole in their heart? And second of all, how hard is it for some people to figure out what it's going to take to fill it?
Yeah, I think everybody has issues that they're dealing with and therefore opportunities to grow more good things inside themselves. You know, my own view, and it's not an original view, is that life's about learning. And also my own view is that life has many difficulties. Life is hard in a lot of ways. It's often hard in profound ways for people. So the question then becomes, how do we deal with the hard things in life? How do we grow the resilience, the even-keeledness, the perspective, you know, the unconditional happiness, the inner peace, what have you? How do we grow those things inside ourselves? And if you know, now some people in particular, me included, I think a large fraction of the population, have issues that have still lingered from their childhood or from experiences they've had in adulthood, maybe a rocky marriage or a tough job or being mistreated or betrayed by somebody that still lingers inside yourself. You can address the lingering effects of that by deliberately looking for those positive experiences that are the natural antidote to that issue. And if you want, you can use the fourth step of this four-step process, as you know, Jeff, in the book, that links positive experiences with the negative material inside yourself that these positive experiences are the natural antidote for, by simply being aware of both a useful positive experience and its related negative material, since, quote-unquote, neurons that fire together wire together. You can gradually associate the positive material to the negative. This is a very familiar method, you know, in psychology. I certainly didn't invent it. But you can do it really skillfully in everyday life and gradually heal yourself from the inside out.
And the HEAL becomes an acronym in your hands. Have a positive experience, enrich it, absorb it, and link the positive and the negative. And the whole back part of the book, the whole second part of the book, is really about engaging the HEAL process. But before we get there, though, we need some of our primitive responses still, don't we? I mean, this is what keeps us alive.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, again, a very subtle and important point. You know, we need the whole brain working together. I think sometimes the reptile brain gets a bad name. You know, it's a very important part of us, you know, kind of rooted in the brainstem. And obviously when things are hard, you know, if you're being attacked by a charging lion in the savannah, or these days someone suddenly is cutting you off in traffic and getting really aggressive with you, or maybe you just have a situation where, you know, someone in your life is in a conflict with you. You know, you need to rise to the occasion or deal with social injustice, you know, help make the world a better place. We do need to be able to fire up. But as the book goes into, the brain basically has two settings. It's kind of green zone responsive mode, which is where it defaults when there's an underlying felt sense of our core needs being met, our three fundamental needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection. That's our resting state, the green zone. We also have this mode, we fire up into the red zone reactive mode when we need to fight or flight, right? Or freeze, let's say. So we need both settings, but Mother Nature's plan is for animals, including us, to spend most of their time in the green zone because it's sustainable. It's the homeostatic equilibrium condition, and the body is also repairing and refueling itself. The problem is, while in modern life most of us are not running it, you know, in fear from a charging lion, we're kind of trapped in lives with chronic mild to moderate stress in red zone, in other words, the reactive mode, with very little opportunity for recovery from them. So for me, the takeaway point is to do what we can to change the world for the better, but meanwhile, having noticed that the world doesn't change very quickly, meanwhile, we can use opportunities in everyday life to really register that our core needs are fundamentally met, overcome the negativity bias of the brain, and then increasingly we're able to deal with life's challenges while staying in the green zone, you know, and not tipping over into that red zone, which is so costly both in terms of personal well-being as well as long-term physical health.
Neuropsychologist Rick Hansen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. Hardwiring as in rewiring, getting your brain to figure things out a little differently with a little assist from your conscious self. Here's Michael in Mendocino. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rick Hansen.
Well, good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Hansen, I'm surprised at how much this segment of the program dovetails with the guests that Jeff had on just prior to you. I'd like to ask you if what you're talking about is an individual's ability to reprogram their own cells. And I'm wondering, with your last discussion on the primitive part of the brain in modern society, and the chronic problem of short-term memory loss or even long-term memory loss in older people, have you done any research on how to overcome this memory loss in older people? And of course, I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
That's a very important question. And slowly but surely, like everybody, becoming one of those older people, you know, I have a real interest in this. I'm not a super specialist in, for example, dementia and other more normal conditions, I would say. I think the research shows in general that common sense practices such as, you know, exercise, eating well, avoiding toxins, and using your mind as much as you can, mental activity, do tend to preserve memory function. Memory is a very vulnerable function in the brain. If you think about it, it's what tends to go when we're depressed or had a head injury or are aging. One thing also I think that people can do to protect memory function, and there's some research on this, is do some kind of contemplative practice. In addition to the good old-fashioned advice, you know, of hanging out with, of having good friends and, you know, exercise and so forth, doing some kind of prayer or mindfulness activity or both even on a regular basis does probably protect memory function, and there's some beginning signs of this. For one, it can help reduce stress, and cortisol, as produced by stress, is very bad for a key region of the brain, the hippocampus, which is very involved in protecting memory and doing memory for us. And then second, one thing that any kind of contemplative practice, meditation, and so forth can do for a person, including, you know, practices that are fairly brief, but hopefully, you know, routine, even daily, like 10 minutes or so or more even a day, is that those practices build up structures in the brain that are involved in the executive functions, those structures being just behind your forehead in the prefrontal regions. And these executive functions help focus attention and help us sustain our attention to the experiences that we do want to take in, which is a way to support memory function.
Structurally, I mean, neuroplasticity acknowledged here. Structurally, does the brain fight some of this rewiring?
The idea is very astute. The brain has to balance, on the one hand, its need to preserve a kind of stability, because otherwise, if the brain was constantly changing, right, we couldn't remember anything, because memory involves some kind of stability, right, of representing, like how to ride a bike, or navigate a tricky conversation with a loved one, or, you know, what's the capital of Oregon, for example. On the other hand, the brain has to be able to change. If it doesn't change, then people become too rigid, too reflexive. And to go to your point about the more ancient regions of the brain, those are the most rigid parts. They are the least able to learn. If you think of it metaphorically speaking, and, you know, I don't know if you're like me, even there's an experience of this, it's like having an inner lizard, mouse, and monkey inside that loosely correspond to the reptilian, mammalian, and primate stages of brain evolution. Well, the monkey inside us, or the, you know, the early human, as it were, is much more able to learn than the mouse, the subcortical limbic regions, the emotional brain, so-called. And that inner mouse is more able to learn than the inner lizard. So if you're grappling with issues that feel particularly rigid, especially related to threat, because that's what the ancient reptilian brainstem is most focused on. You know, rule one in the wild is, you know, live to see the sunrise. Eat lunch today, don't be lunch today, right? So if you're grappling with issues of anxiety or anger or trauma or feelings of helplessness or feeling unprotected, all of which get at the ancient need for safety, which is managed very much by the brainstem and related structures at its root, well, those experiences of anxiety need a lot of counter conditioning. They need a lot of alternative learning. You need to pet the lizard a lot. So you need to take in the good a lot in terms of experiences that are real for you, of feeling strong or relaxed or noticing you're all right now or feeling protected or feeling safer, because those are, as it were, antidote experiences that particularly target feelings of anxiety and particularly address those ancient reptilian needs to stay out of trouble.
We have a call here for Rick Hansen, the author of Hardwiring Happiness. Here's Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Rick.
Hi there, good morning.
A couple of comments and then a question for you, Rick. My contemplative exercise is I do crossword puzzles, which I find is very good because I come from an English major background, so I'm kind of like focused in the English language and words and manipulation thereof. And another thing that, here's something I did, which I think developed a very good memory with regard to the little darlings who were doing the trick-or-treating yesterday, last night. I offered them, and I showed them the packages of each. I showed them the packages of some prepackaged prunes, and I threw those into the bags with them. And when their faces fell, I showed them the package of the candy, and I put candy in their bags around the same time as I put the prunes around in. And so I think I made a permanent impression upon them that this is the guy who tricked them and treated them at the same time. And my question is to you, Rick, is that this is a theory. I've asked this of other guests on Jeffrey's program before. It's like, why do you think it is that the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body and vice versa? Because I think it was because back in evolutionary days, if one was attacked at the head part, they needed the other side of the body to defend itself. And Jeffrey, if any of that makes any sense with your guest, I'll just take his responses off of the phone.
All right. I'm not sure the prunes make sense, but the rest of it's fine. Thanks for that, James. I appreciate it.
That's great. Well, a couple things there. Three, actually. One is that kids are very quick to change their brain based on their experiences. So I think that there's also a lot of opportunity for people who are parents or teachers to look for opportunities with children to help them actually take the extra 10 or 20 seconds to register their experiences, especially positive ones, so they sink in. Maybe their natural opportunities at school, moments of reflection, or just before recess, or just after recess, or at the end of a day. And also parents can do this kind of thing with kids, you know, just before sleep. Second, and I'll be quick on this one, the question about the bilateral crossover of the brain, you know, the left side, as your caller points out, controlling the right side of the body, et cetera, why in the world would that originate? And there are different theories about that, and I think your caller's theory is extremely plausible.
All right, that you need the other side, if you're attacked on the left side of your head, to be
exactly
able to fight off the battle there.